I'm Kate Remington. I'm talking with David Rosenmeyer. He's the conductor of the Fairfield County Chorale and the music director. And you've got a spectacular concert coming out with Bach's B minor Mass. And David, it's so wonderful to have a chance to talk to you about it.
Great to be here.
This is such an incredible work. And maybe before we get into the nuts and bolts and look under the hood a little bit, I'd love to know why you decided that this was the perfect time to perform the B minor Mass.
Well, it's one of those works that members who already sang it want to do it again, and those who haven't can't wait to do it. And it's also a personal thing. I've been I worked on it as an assistant for a couple of times. I know it. I hear it. And this is frankly my first time conducting the whole thing. So I just wanted to do it. And with the chorus, when I started 5 years and a half ago, we talked about what the chorus wants to do, what I thought they should do, and you know, we planned season per season. But I also had a goal like that will be a landmark, and we've been programming our last three seasons based on preparing ourselves for this. So it's not a decision that was now to do the B minor Mass. It's already 4 years ago we said we're going to do a few pieces on the way that will kind of train us and teach us what about ourselves so we can tackle this amazing piece.
That sounds like just a phenomenal journey, and I hadn't really thought about it in that way. I mean, obviously you program years in advance, and to have this as sort of the reward for working through all those other pieces must have been just so great for the chorale and the orchestra.
It is. And the amazing thing is that it's both a reward, and at the same time, it's the greatest teacher, because we just have to solve challenges. We have to solve problems. We have to figure out how to make what's written on the page sound well. And so we just have to learn how to do that. And then it teaches us about ourselves in so many different ways. And so it is spectacular, really.
It's such an incredible work. And it has such an amazing history, because it was written over the span of quite a few years. 25 is one of the things that I read.
And, yes.
And it's also likely that Bach never intended the whole thing ever to be performed in his lifetime, or certainly that wasn't the goal when he put it together.
I agree with you. Yeah. I agree with you. I mean, there are different theories, but I agree with you completely that was the case. And it's actually hard to think about it, because we think about it in 2018 minds, and for us, we assume certain things as being a given. And so it's hard to us to think of Bach writing such a piece and not intending it to be performed. But I actually believe that's the case. But I don't think that conversations ends there. It's more complex, because it's not that it's the contrary of wanting it to be performed. It's simply a different paradigm from a different time.
Yeah, and what's so cool about it, too, I mean, some of it was performed in his lifetime.
Yes.
And he showed it to the new Elector of Saxony, because it's so interesting. You think that he was all happy working at the St. Thomas Church, but in fact, he never stopped really wanting something bigger. And so showing this to this Elector of Saxony was almost like a job application.
Oh, it
in a
was.
Way.
Yeah. Absolutely, it was. And he wasn't happy at Leipzig. Let's just admit it, and let's not get it out of the way. He moved to Leipzig for very different reasons, and his pay from his previous job, now I'm suddenly blanking, I think it was in Weimar that he was just before Leipzig, was actually better than what he had in Leipzig, but he really wanted it for many different reasons. One was the prestige, because it was an important place, but the other one had to do with his children. He wanted for them the best education, and Leipzig was well known for their universities and for the intellectual life. And so he moved there, and he was expecting certain things to improve, which they didn't. In the conditions. So he expected his income to increase, which it didn't. He expected his workload doing other things, like teaching Latin, being a proctor in the school and stuff like that, to decrease, which they didn't. He made some extra money playing in funerals, because that was paid. And you know, we don't think of Bach being a funny person, but One comment he made was here. He said, like, this was a bad year because nobody died. People were healthy. So he didn't make the extra money. So and at some point, his older son was already playing and in Dresden. So it's absolutely, I believe, exactly like you're saying, that when he wrote the first part of what is now the B minor mass, which he called the Missa at the time, it was actually performed in Dresden. And no doubt that he was considering it a job application. He thoroughly studied the style of Dresden, which was different from Leipzig. It was more five voices as opposed to four voices. He studied the Catholic masses that were very prevalent in Dresden that were not so common in Leipzig, so he could imitate that Italian style. And he wrote a couple of Polish little tunes into that Missa, because as you were saying, Augustus III was also crowned a king of Poland and Dresden. So he was totally working it. But then that was 1733. So then in 1747, when he writes the B minor mass, he uses that and other sources and starts adapting for different reasons, thinking of the whole of what is now the B minor mass.
And it's so incredible, because once he added those extra sections, the Credo and the Sanctus and the Agnus Dei, it was way longer than any church service would have, or a mass in a church service at that time.
Exactly, so. which would confirm the point that it wasn't intended for a performance. And again, it doesn't mean that he didn't think maybe that it could be performed.
Yeah.
It lies in that limbo place. Yeah.
Well, the other cool thing about it is that he recycled a lot of material from some of his cantatas and then from some of his instrumental work. And some of them are like gone now. There's no manuscript. And so the only record we have of them is the way that he used them in the B minor mass. And so it's almost like this core sample of what he thought was his best work, too.
Well, maybe what you just said is actually the clue to what was he after, actually. You know, because we tend to think of a composer composing a piece. But in this case, maybe the best word is not Bach composed the B minor mass. Bach created the B minor mass. And it was using older compositions and using almost a collage to put it together. But like you just, something that you just said, I think goes to the heart of the situation, which is kind of like the core sample of his best. Mm-hmm. Right. And so one can think that the B minor mass is not only can be looked at as a work or as a piece from beginning to end, but actually as a collection, that he wanted to present a collection of vocal and choral works, the same way that the violin sonatas or some of the organ or some of the what we call the piano or keyboard music are collections, right? Yeah. And so in that way, he was maybe wanting to leave a legacy of saying, this is who I was in terms of my vocal composition, kind of like presenting a sample of, this is me doing Stile Antico, this is me pretending to be Italian or French, this is me thinking of the future, this is me writing fugues, right? So he puts it all together in what is really a collection as well as one long piece. And also we have to remember it's 1747, so he's what, 62 years old. Mm-hmm. His eyesight is terrible. He's terrible, and we know that from the things that he actually wrote, like the handwriting is really bad because he didn't see well. So. And he might have been tired. So maybe his intention wasn't really to compose in the sense of what we think now of composing, getting inspired and writing a new idea, but actually to create this collection and this legacy that was also intellectual and, you know, highly numerological in many levels as well. So he was putting together many aspects.
Yeah, and it kind of is a parallel composition to the art of the fugue, because again, that has a sort of, well, to me, kind of otherworldly quality, because again, he didn't specify what instruments could play it, and it's music that just kind of exists outside of time or outside of his regular, you know, standard catalog of stuff.
Absolutely, absolutely, you're so right about that. And I think that in the last, it's 1747, and in the last 15 years, he didn't write much. You know, after the big the big passions, and he wrote already the Cycle of Cantatas. I have a feeling that he was probably tired, you know, like had all those children and his second wife and cousins and commitments and teaching Latin and all that and the organs. And he probably, and as you said before, he probably had an ambition of more, but his ambitions were also intellectual and theological, and in a way that is, again, hard to imagine in a 21st century mind. Those two realms were actually going together in him. And in The Art of the Fugue, there is a lot, and other things that he did at that time, there are many things that have to do with riddles and cues and a way of challenging not the listener, but the reader of his music to come up with solutions. And they are very deeply theological as well. And in the B minor Mass, it's full of that, full of riddles and cues and why that number. And we know that he added to, like you were saying, he recycled a lot of work. And in some cases, he added three measures or one measure or six measures and stuff like that. And it's you know, and only when you start seeing certain very bizarre proportions that it actually makes sense why he did that. So he was doing something else than only putting the notes on the paper.
Yeah, it just stylistically, it's so interesting because the symmetry and the architecture of it, it's like a cathedral unto itself with the way he laid out the movements.
Incredibly so, yes.
Yeah. And we've talked about Handel's Messiah and how it never stopped being popular. It never dropped out of people's consciousness, unlike the B minor Mass, because little bits of it were performed, but the whole thing wasn't performed until well after 100 years after Bach died. And I'm sort of curious about how people came to think about it as not a living thing like Messiah, but as a historical document, and if that changed the people's approach to it, I guess.
Well, that's such a great question. And I think, you know, I can't imagine people in his time sitting for an uninterrupted work like this. It must have suggested like something like very torturous in a way and almost ridiculous. And as you were saying, 100 years later, you know, with the expansion of so many other things, they started putting it on, and it was almost a curiosity. And actually, there were many decades and situations where it was appropriate and it was customary to play parts of it. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, the first, I think I might be mistaken, and maybe that the first actually performance of this was C.P.E. Bach, his Bach's son, performing just the Credo a few years after Bach died. So the idea of the whole or the parts was open, and then it kind of entered the repertoire, and we just accepted as a given. You know, it's Handel Messiah, Beethoven 9th, B minor Mass, which of course also the name is putative.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't call it like that, and it's a misnomer because B minor is not really such an important key in the piece, but it starts in B minor. And so it kind of became like that, and then it's just putative in the sense that people just accept it. Okay, that's what it is. But it's one of those works that challenges, especially me in the sense of the conductor, from that point of view that knowing that it's a piece not originally intended to be performed, but actually to make a performance that makes sense. I want the people leaving the audience that night to live happy and fulfilled, that they had an event that inspires them, that maybe also challenged them in some way, but that is satisfactory. And so we have to treat it as a concert piece as well. So,
well, there's certainly a lot of drama in it. And even though Bach never wrote any operas, there are moments that just like make you hold your breath almost in anticipation. And it's just so incredibly exciting.
Yes. It's interesting. Bach, when he was in his early 20s, I think he was in Hamburg, and he hung around and he met Telemann, who was already becoming Telemann, and he was writing opera. And he did like opera. He didn't dislike opera. And I agree with you absolutely. And the fact that this is done without recitative, which is very much like the opera that he does use in his Passions, is even more telling that he's able to do this with just chorus and soloists.
Yeah, it's amazing. And you mentioned earlier in our conversation that it's been a multi-year journey to work up to this and to kind of train for this, sort of like you train for a marathon. But what are some of the specific challenges that you or the chorus have with bringing this piece to life?
Well, there are two realms of the challenges. One is the practical. We just have to sing it mm-hmm. and play it. And it's just hard. It's just incredibly difficult. And as I was saying before, we did this three-year preparation. So we did 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, we did the Bach Magnificat mm-hmm. that also has some things that the B minor mass has. It has movements in five voices. It has coloraturas, but it's a total of 35 minutes, including the soloists. And last year we did a devilishly hard piece by Handel called the Dixit Dominus mm-hmm. that he wrote when he was young. And that also is in five voices, and it's also 30 minutes. And here we are with the B minor mass, right? So there is a level of just practicality. The first movement of the mass, the Kyrie, the first Kyrie, there are two, is 13 minutes long.
Wow.
13 minutes long. So finding the pacing, singing the right notes in tune, singing all the notes, because there are so many coloraturas, then making sure that we actually hear all the notes. And at the same time, we don't want it to be pedantic. Right. We don't want anybody in the audience to feel that they're going to a lecture or to a presentation. It needs to be a concert.
Right.
But if Bach wrote all those notes, probably he wanted them to be heard somewhere. And although Bach didn't intend it to be performed, he had in his mind a paradigm of the choruses that existed at his time. And they would, like the extremely very large choruses of Dresden might have been 15 people, maybe 20, and especially, and you know, and we are 110.
Wow.
And we still, so we don't want to cut our wings and repress our intentions. We want to sing full-heartedly, committed, engaged, and at the same time we want the texture to be alive and recognizable by the audience. So that is one challenge. Then mm-hmm. there's the other challenge, which is to answer the question, what is this?
Right.
And so for me it is delving in and seeing, comparing one number to each other, definitely a lot of counting measures and seeing proportions and seeing his constant way of inserting himself through numbers, because he had a very keen relationship with the way that letters can be named in numbers, and he would bring his kind of signature in certain amount of measures and stuff like that, and he kept doing that. He did that all his life. But as you were saying, in the Art of the Fugue, he just keep repeating certain numbers all over again, and in key moments, it's like, you know, for example, in the movement of Confiteor, which is I confess my sins, mm-hmm. you know, just at the end of the credo, at the end of the affirmation of faith, it's I confess my sins, and in the deepest and most transcendent moment of that, which is the et expecto resurrectionem, and I expect to be resurrected after my sins are taken in, you know, mm-hmm. from me. He puts his name all over it. It's like saying, I am the biggest sinner.
Wow.
And it's done by numbers. And it's very clear, not only numbers in terms of the counts, but also in terms of the choice of certain notes that can be used. You know, the B can be used both as the note B or B flat. The A is the A. The H is also the B natural. So he keeps inserting as cues as to say, like, so the challenge is to find those things, to be inspired by them, and not to fall in the rabbit hole, which is only to look for those things.
Right, sure.
That's also a challenge.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. Is that knowing those little motifs? I mean, now I'm going to be listening to it with fresh ears, because I didn't realize how much cryptography he put in the manuscript as well.
A lot, and you know, there has been a lot of studies, especially in the last 50 or 60, 70 years, and there are different, and again, it goes to the point of understanding that the paradigm at his time was different from ours. There was a big, big discussion among theorists in his time if harmony, and by harmony, it's not what we mean which is notes sounding together. It was a much broader sense of proportions and relationships. If harmony needed to please the audience or needed to please God in a way that was not hearable. And he took very strongly the second position, which is alien to our modern minds. Our modern minds is like, if you can't hear it, what's the point?
Right. Yeah.
But he would do things that are incredibly complex to make this very, very wide relationships. And that's kind of alien for our modern minds, right? But it's prevalent in ways that are, some of them still not explored. And the funny thing is that they don't take away the enjoyment of the music. It kind of runs in a parallel way. And the music is just beautiful and profound in its own sense.
It's going to be an amazing experience. And David, thank you so much for coming in and spending some time talking about it, because it sounds like it's just going to be an incredible event.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for supporting our chorus so much. Thank you so much.